you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Andy Nowicki back on the show. Andy is the author of 8 books, including Conspiracy, Compliance, and Control. I'm sorry, Conspiracy, Compliance, Control, and Defiance, What Is and What Is to Be Done. He is also the assistant editor of Alternative Right and the host of the Nameless Podcast. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm good, Tim. Good to be with you, as always.
Well, thank you for coming back. Now, you've had a series of YouTube postings that I thought were interesting, very thoughtful and also provocative in their own way, regarding, well, one thing is MGTOW, Men Going Their Own Way, the men's rights movement, and also, well, you can say the trouble with modern women. I guess you can boil it down, what's wrong with women these days. Now, of course, what's wrong with men these days, but I've had a few shows talking about that. Talking about, you know, things like pornography and the sexual revolution's effect on men. But tonight we'll talk a little bit men, of course, but also you've done a few of these postings regarding women, and of course the reaction to you could say either third wave or fourth wave or whatever wave we're in, feminism,
right.
How it's been internalized by so many women and how it's affected the relationships between the sexes and had a really deleterious effect on society in general. So, Andy, how do you want to take this on? How do you want to start?
Well, thank you for having me on. It's an interesting subject, and the whole subject of MGTOW, men going their own way, is something that I've been kind of consumed with lately, or kind of very, very interested and compelled by. I've sampled a lot of the, really, I guess it's mostly on YouTube, a lot of the YouTube commenters who their takes on things, and I don't call myself MGTOW because I'm, after all, married. So that kind of gets in the way. I'm married and have children, so I'm obviously not going my own way in the sense that they mean by it. But I do think that they really do appear to have their finger on the pulse of something that's real and that's important to address right now. And I think a lot of it is or surrounds the entire issue of what I called in a recent video that I did that I was actually I'm somewhat proud of my way of approaching the subject in this way and kind of turning things on their ear. I talked about how women are the ones who in our day and age have a true commitment problem. And, you know, it's such a standard cliche. Oh, men, they can't commit. You know, it's, what are we going to do about these men? They just want to live extended, you know, adolescence, and they're just, you know, little boys, and they're just never going to become mature. And it's up to women, like the sort of lesson that we're taught, even in some conservative circles, I would say, is that, you know, this very anti-man, you know, very pro-woman approach. And I'm neither pro-man nor anti or pro-woman, by the way. I don't think of myself in those terms at all. But I just try to see that the truth, both men and women, as we tend to be, you know, biologically and culturally and otherwise. And it's so there's this tendency right now to present to us to render to us this image of men as kind of boorish and maybe not boorish, but just immature and you know, just wanting to live like frat boys, you know, into their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and whatever. And then women are the really mature ones. They come along. They're the civilizing force in culture, you know, and so men eventually settle down, they marry, and that's and then they become the men that they were supposed to be thanks to the women who civilized them. And again, this is a kind of a sort of conservative construal of it. It's a kind of, I would say it's a kind of feminism, a kind of anti-male presentation of things, and you know, pro-female presentation of things, but it's a, you know, also a certain image of marriage and the family, and it's to me it's just laced with holes. It's just very lacking, and rather, you know, in contradistinction to this portrayal or this construal of men as the ones with commitment problems, I argue in this video that it's women, not men, who are actually the ones who tend to have, in our day and age, who tend to have problems with commitment. And it's a much more insidious problem with commitment, because it is, you know, to the extent that marriage hasn't been completely decimated by the sexual revolution and all the negative and destructive cultural forces that have ravaged you know, the relationships between the sexes, and we've talked about those in our prior interviews, you know, at some length. But to the extent that marriage still does exist, it is still something. You know, the old scenario of the woman being a man and a woman are going out, you know, their boyfriend and girlfriend, and the woman is the one who wants him to pop the question, and he's reluctant to do so. I mean, that still holds true to a great extent. But my take on that is, you know, marriage is a big step, and it's not really a commitment problem if you're, you know, if you haven't made a commitment yet. I mean, if you're trying to decide whether you can be committed to this person for the rest of your life, that's a wise, I mean, that's something that you shouldn't just go into in a, you know, blithely and, you know, without considering whether it's possible or not, whether it's something that's the best thing for the both of you. But again, the scenario as it usually unfolds, as I have observed, and all of what I'm talking about is just, you know, through my observations of, you know, people I know and, you know, friends and acquaintances and, you know, certainly some autobiographical element as well. But it's after marriage, after the woman has, you know, badgered the guy into, you know, and guilted him and shamed and said, come on, you got to stand up, you got to man up, put a ring on my finger and show me that you're committed to me. What are we doing here otherwise? And so he finally decides, yeah, okay, will you marry me? And so they, and she says, yes, you know, what took you so long to ask? And then they get married, and they're married for, you know, however long, maybe they're happy for a certain length of time. And then it's my observation that at some point it's the woman who suddenly, I shouldn't say suddenly, because it's not necessarily a sudden thing. Sometimes it's slowly unfolding, but it's the woman who looks up and finds that the man that she married isn't measuring up in her mind to some standard that she has always maybe unconsciously held. He's not successful enough. He's not romantic enough. He's not helping out around the house enough. He's not this enough. He's not that enough. He doesn't really help to discipline the kids. He's too much of a pushover with the kids, or, you know, he doesn't do the dishes to her satisfaction, or, I mean, all of these things that seem rather trivial, but they kind of pile up. I mean, some of them are trivial. Some of these things are, you know, significant. And I think one thing is, you know, a woman wants a man with who will be a provider, and she would like a man with some degree of status, and that, you know, that's a turn on to women. And there's nothing, you know, inherently wrong with that. But in my estimation, the way that things stand now, in what's, you know, what the MGTOW guys call a gynocentric culture, you know, a culture that's endlessly indulgent to the female side of things, and, you know, dogged and critical, and, you know, at times very virulently anti-male, anti-masculine, denigrating of the masculine. In that kind of culture, this sense of, again, to use another buzzword, hypergamy, that women tend to have, the hypergamy is, you know, gets kind of out of control to the extent that in many cases, a woman who has already committed to a man, who has already tied the knot, as they say, and she's, you know, she was usually in most cases the one who, you know, pushed things along to the point where he proposed to her in the first place. You know, a few years later, a few years down the line, she's finding that she's just not impressed with him, and that, you know, she could do better. And again, for reasons that, I mean, again, in my estimation, don't amount to, I mean, are not justified. I mean, there's nothing you can, it's okay to feel disappointment. You know, we all feel disappointment with one another. We all let each other down in one way or the other. But again, my sense is that these aren't cases where, and again, this is maybe another point I should make. These are not cases where the man has done something egregiously wrong, you know, where he's been unfaithful or become a drug addict or has just decided he's not going to, not going to work and just going to, watch porn all day.
This isn't a male bashing Lifetime original film starring Susan right. Lucci or something. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just, in most cases, he's faithful. He's committed. He's doing his part, but he somehow just doesn't measure up to what she thought he would be.
Yeah, there's Roger Devlin has a, in his book Sexual Utopia and Power, cites a statistic: 2/3 of divorces are initiated by women. And right. He writes, the common pattern is that women are the first to want into a marriage and the first to want out.
Yeah, exactly. And if it can be, I guess it's on a continuum, like it could be something where the woman just you know, and as he points out, and I think it's borne out by the evidence, something like 75% of marriages, I mean, of divorces are initiated by the women. Now, we can posit that in some of those cases, maybe the women, or in some of the cases, the women certainly probably want out for justified reasons, like he's beating her, or he's fooling around on her, or something like that, something, you know, particularly egregious. But my suspicion is that in a lot of the cases, it's not that at all. It's just that she's fallen out of love and, you know, again, feels like she can do better. Or maybe she's met someone who's got it more going on. And, you know, it's the sense of hypergamy. It's not the hypergamy in itself. And this is, I think, maybe how I would distinguish my perspective from some of the MGTOW guys who just are wanting to say, well, look, it's just what women are like. They're faithless. They're, you know, they'll just, they like you until somebody better comes along, and then they'll immediately drop you like a hot potato and go with this new stud, you know, who's making more money than you, or just more confident, or, you know, exudes more confidence or whatever.
Yeah. But I mean, these proclivities are natural. It's like men's proclivity to fool around. Is they can be curbed or restrained by, you know, societal institutions, morality, things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the problem isn't the problem. I mean, we all have temptations, proclivities that we're, things that our baser selves are inclined to. But because we are not just animals, we have free will, and we can say no. You know, it's sort of, I gave the example of, in one of my videos, I gave the example of, you know, a man is married for 10 years, and, you know, maybe his wife was in better shape when they married, but now she's, you know, put on a few pounds and is, you know, less interested in sex and whatever. And then someday some 18-year-old throws herself at him. A good man, a noble man, will still say, no, as much as I might want to do this, I'm not going to, because I'm committed to my wife, and this is the path that I've chosen. And so he rejects doing this thing that, again, the baser part of him wants. But and with women, it's the sort of the same thing. And I gave the example of, you know, so the scenario that I'm talking about here, where that I was talking about a few minutes ago, that say a man and a woman are married for 10 years, 15 years, and the husband is not really killing it, you know, at the job. He's not, he's been passed over for promotions a couple of times. Maybe he's been fired a couple of times because the market is bad, but he's doing his best, or, you know, he's trying. But then she runs into an ex, you know, somebody that she'd gone out with before she met her husband, and he's doing really well, and he's just confident, and he's looking great, and he says, "Look, you know, why don't you leave that? I mean, we've always had a real connection, haven't we, you and I? Why don't you leave your loser husband behind and take up with me?" Now, that same sort of case, the woman is no doubt tempted the same way that the man is tempted by the 18-year-old in the scenario I gave a few minutes ago. But if she, you know, is a woman of character, she'll say no. She'll say no. I'm married to my husband. I love him. I'm committed to him. And that is that. But the problem is that we live in a time where it's sort of this "you go girl" kind of thing, that the woman is, you know, is just indulged and pampered, and you know, we're encouraged to see her as a queen and as a princess and, you know, whatever kind of royalty, and her proclivities are somehow, you know, the negative aspects of her proclivities are glossed over. And so, you know, in these cases where she just decides to kick her husband to the curb, and, you know, in these egregious sort of cases, you know, have an affair or you know, take up with this other guy who's just more successful and doing better or whatever, you know, is more of a man in her eyes, you know, following this, her hypergamous, you know, proclivities or temptations. We live in a time where that sort of thing, that sort of behavior, that sort of crappy behavior on a woman's part is somehow construed as okay. And, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, we all fall apart. I mean, we all, you know, people fall out of love. It happens and we move on, you know, and so in that way, the woman's choice to, you know, her faithlessness, the absence of commitment that she is showing, which I want to make it clear, this is a much more egregious absence of commitment than what the man gets pilloried for, because, you know, even if it is a, you know, a stereotypical case of a guy just wanting to live it up and not wanting to settle down, and, you know, in that case, who else is he hurting? I mean, he hasn't made a commitment to anyone, so it's not like he's being faithless to anyone. But the cases I'm talking about are where a man and a woman, where a man has committed himself to a woman, and then the woman suddenly or slowly, but eventually comes to decide that he's just not living up to what she wants or expects of him. And then in that case, you know, maybe there are children already, maybe not, but even if there aren't children, you know, they've had a bond that was, you know, that was solidified by marriage and supposed to be till death do us part, and, you know, barring egregious circumstances, and, you know, suddenly everything is destroyed. And it's a much more destructive overall kind of tendency if left unchecked. And unfortunately, I think today it is, to a great extent, being left unchecked. And that's a big part of why. I mean, it's one aspect of why we're in the terrible shape that we're in right now here in the modern West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, one of the things is, of course, you have, I think, close to, is it 85% in divorce, the woman automatically gets custody, and the man will get
visitation. Oh, yeah. There's that side of it too,
which would penalize her if she were, if she were to break a marriage commitment, break that contract with no fault divorce. There's no penalty for breaking that contract.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and
exactly.
Then she gets custody of the children, whereas in the past, I think, prior, in the early part of the 20th century, custody would default to the man, to the father, and this tended to keep women in relationships. You can say, well, it kept them in abusive relationships. Well, if you take them, you know, obviously, if your example is always the worst case scenario, it's going to look bad. You could go the other way too. So, obviously, if a woman feels no immediate consequences for breaking the contract, even not losing her, even losing her kids, and even getting the house, where she can, you know. Idea of community property and these things, and obviously the woman's claim to the man's resources is based on her devotion to him. And the man in return,
you would think so in a sane, civilized world that it would be, yes.
And that's been broken now.
Yes.
Where, you know, the thing is not so much. I think has been said. I think Roger Devlin puts it this way: is men's rights. It shouldn't be couched in those terms because it sounds like their shrill feminist counterparts. Everyone demands their rights, but no one's acknowledging their duties and obligations. And with every right, there's an obligation, a duty. And with every duty and obligation, there's a right. And now that's been broken because we live in an age where everyone talks about their rights, to right to this, to right to that, without any sense of their own obligations or responsibilities in these things. That's been broken.
Right. Now, interestingly, within this whole context, within this whole framework, you know, I used to think that feminism was just sort of meant to be the dominant ideology. It was, you know, if, as you say, it's true, and I agree that it's true to a large extent, that it's been an artificially promoted thing, and, you know, encouraged by various institutions, you know, for various nefarious reasons, to the breakup of the family has been engineered in the West, and, you know, in order to increase the power of the state and all these kinds of things. I used to think that that was the be all, and that the attempt was going to be made. So a few years ago, my fear of what was going to happen in the world was that all of the degenerate Western mores that prevail now would be spread to all corners of the globe. And so they would, you know, make, we'd see, you know, gay liberationism and feminism and all these other destructive ideologies, you know, exported to the Middle East and to, you know, to Asia and Africa and all these kind of places. And that would be the way it was going to go. But I think the last few years, we've taken a very different turn, and maybe this has always been the plan, but it dawned on me recently that with the immigration crisis, with the refugee crisis, with the powers that be in the West just flinging open the doors, flinging open the floodgates and letting in all these people from these other parts of the world come in, where it's like it's patriarchal, you know, with a vengeance. You know, it's patriarchal in a way that the West was never patriarchal, and where there was never any semblance of, you know, dignity for or sense of dignity for the female of the species. And what we're seeing now that I think is kind of extraordinary, in, you know, with the migrant crisis in Europe, is these, you know, powers that be steeped in cultural Marxism and all of these negative degenerate ideologies, we see them suddenly talking like, well, we should respect these patriarchal cultures. And, you know, it's like feminism, Western feminism has been trumped by multiculturalism, by, you know, anti-white multiculturalism. And so I think it's interesting. It's almost like we're seeing, you know, that Western feminism was always, or was maybe not always, maybe I shouldn't be totally categorical, but was generally only about, you know, neutering white male masculinity. And now, you know, we've got this situation where, like, everything is upside down in, you know, in such a peculiar way, but maybe an orchestrated way, that, you know, we've got the feminist party in Sweden going to the Middle East, all, you know, wearing headdresses and being, or to Iran, I think it is. They're visiting Iran. Maybe you heard about this a few months ago, and they're all wearing headdresses and being demure and, you know, showing, their obedience to the patriarchy, the non-white patriarchy, whereas, you know, the conservative, the right-wing forces in Europe, rallying behind a woman like Marine Le Pen, you know, who refuses, makes a big show out of refusing to wear the headscarf, and it's like, so now it's become enlightened to be, respectful of these, you know, intensely patriarchal foreign cultures. And, you know, like, you know, people in Germany, you know, they say that, you know, people like women get assaulted, and then these cultural Marxist powers that be lecture them by saying things like, well, you were dressed too provocatively, you should be respectful of their cultures, things that they would never say, like...
Yeah, imagine fraternity yeah. boy saying that on a college
campus. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that they would never say if it was white guys. You know, they would never say, oh, you were just... they would explode in anger and self-righteous fury if anybody said anything like that, if it were, you know, in circumstances involving Western men. But because, you know, with these Middle Eastern men or Pakistani men or wherever, then again, feminism is getting trumped by, you know, this enforced deference for, you know, non-white patriarchy. And
well, they're intentionally creating a volatile situation for the reaction.
Yes.
The actions in the reaction. And that's the same thing that has occurred here in the United States. More liberal societies, so it's a little different. But the same way they've highly sexualized the culture, they've normalized pornography, they've created a situation on college campuses which is completely debased and hostile to any traditional sense of morality or decency or modesty. They throw these, you know, young people together in co-ed dorms. They subsidize the party life and atmosphere, the drinking. Then they are surprised when, you know, a woman has an unfortunate sexual encounter. What I mean by that is not necessarily rape or assault. It's called date rape. They redefine rape to mean absolutely anything. It's when a woman
drunken
has
sex.
Regrets about her dalliance the night before because she got drunk, or now she doesn't think the young man who she had relations the night before isn't showing enough respect, didn't call her, or she just has to regret, or she went through her sociology class the next day and learned that she was raped.
Yeah, right.
And then all the powers of the university, the institutions, come on her side and deprive the young man of due process, anything approaching due process, presumption of innocence, or just common sense. And so, but it's intentional. They want this to occur. I mean, and that's the same thing in Europe.
Yeah.
They bring in all these people from a foreign nation, a much more conservative society, and they're dumped in the middle of a very permissive European culture, which has been subjected to 40, 50 years of psychological warfare, promoting sexual degeneracy, family breakup. They've weakened the host culture, which is highly degenerate and highly sexualized, and they bring in this foreign element and creates this environment. The same thing, from what I understand, also has occurred in India, where they liberalized a lot of the media, and now they're pumping in Western media and pornography, and it's creating what they call a rape crisis in India, because the culture in India is now being invaded by all the sexual licentiousness of the West, and the young men don't know how to respond to it. And if you have any understanding of human psychology or anthropological understanding, and this is precisely what these malevolent forces are experts in, is weaponizing anthropology, is they can do this. It's the same way that Margaret Mead and her book, you know, about Samoa, the target wasn't Samoans, the targets were Americans. You know, basically it was her way to rationalize infidelity because she was having an affair. But the same way, the reason why she was promoted is because those forces at the same time of the 1940s, 1950s, were seeding the ground for the sexual revolution of the 1960s, which for the most part was foundation funded, backed by intelligence agencies, and backed by corporate America, you know, mass media. These things were all promoted for a reason, to get the environment that has existed since the 1960s, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse. You know, so
I'm just wondering. You know, lately I'm wondering though if the end game in the West hasn't always been to employ feminism. I mean, I don't know, thinking conspiratorially here, because I don't claim to know necessarily what the end game is, or if it's all, you know, contrived, or to what extent it's just chaotic. But it seems more like recently that the end game has been to use feminism as a battering ram to destroy the institution of the family among white Western people, and then to bring in these other cultures with, you know, where there's, you know, patriarchy to the max, you know, and no critique is forthcoming of their patriarchy. And so it's like, what's going to happen in that case? Well, when enough of them come in, when enough of a, you know, fiercely patriarchal culture comes in to and meets up with this degenerate culture in decline, where the men are all have all been weakened. And
well, yeah, if men, like I said, the idea is you, in order to get to the women, you first take out the men.
And so,
they've done that psychologically in Europe. They're doing here in the United States.
And so the end game seems to be to destroy the traditional Western culture in order to let it be colonized by these other elements, and then maybe that in turn helps to strengthen the power of the puppet masters.
Yeah, because you have weakened families. You if you don't have families, you don't have extended families. You don't have extended families, you don't have, I would say virtually autonomous communities, which are self-governing.
Yes.
And they create these institutions, these little platoons of liberty, as Edmund Burke called them. And and these are, these manifest themselves in, organizations. It's the churches, it's the parishes and these things. And these can, collectively, these are bulwarks against the forces of globalism, because they present a resistance to sort of this attempt to sort of create an homogenous global culture, which is seen, break everything down. And the solvent here is the free market, supposedly, capitalism, marketing. And obviously, from a marketing standpoint, it's less easier if you have a global culture and you have Coca-Cola everywhere as opposed to local products and these things.
Within this greater context, I guess the question then comes up concerning MGTOW. And that
men
is
men going their own way.
Yes, men going their own way. Kind of a clumsy anagram, but it's stuck, and it's growing. This movement is growing, and I think there's a debate right now a difference of opinion among the reactionaries, those of us who are opposing all of these malignant trends. There's a debate about whether MGTOW is good or bad, because there are people out there, on the traditionalist right, or even the racialist right, who say, the white race is in decline. We need to marry. We need to reproduce like mad. We just gotta have tons and tons and tons of kids, and because we're demographically declining right now. And so they see MGTOW as a negative thing, because it's like, to them, it's like radical feminists deciding to be lesbians or deciding to not have anything to do with men.
Mm-hmm.
And they say MGTOW is some engineered thing where it's teaching men not to have anything, and Western men not to have anything to do with women. And so it's helping further along this trend. I disagree with that. I mean, maybe you have some take on this whole question as well. I disagree with that take, though. I think that MGTOW is a healthy trend, to the extent that it doesn't. I mean, I think it maybe can go too far in some cases, but in so far as teaching men self-respect, teaching men, not just to be suckers. And not just to be drawn in by, the way that it works now is men are weak-willed, sex-crazed. They want sex, and so they're. I guess these days, it's the sexual mores have disintegrated so much that you don't have to get married to have sex, but. But sex is what draws you the desire for sex is what draws men to women, and women can use it as a bargaining chip and manipulate men in that way. And I think MGTOW teaches men to, not be weak in that way, and to have self-respect, and to not just let themselves be dominated, and not just let themselves be, not let hypergamy run amok the way that it has been. Another interesting thing that I've noted about MGTOW is that there's a lot of black MGTOW. I don't know, which maybe that's another subject that we can you know, maybe we should bracket, but maybe it's too big of an issue here, but or too much of a side issue. But, you know, it's not just white guys who are choosing MGTOW. So the whole idea that it's social engineering against whites, you know, I don't exactly see that. I mean, it is a Western phenomenon in a lot of ways, but anyway, so that's that. That's, I guess, you know, that's some friction that I've met up with some people, you know, when I mention MGTOW to them and when I speak of it in a positive way. I just was curious to know what your thoughts were on that.
Well, I think the concern is being caught in a dialectic or a trap, mm-hmm. and getting you to react a certain way. And if out of frustration or out of righteous indignation, you decide that you will have nothing to do with women, you just, you know, live your own life and you don't ever get married or form a family, you can see how that might be playing into the hands of the oligarchs who seek depopulation and lower birth rates and weaker families and these things. On the other hand, feedback is an important signaling strategy. And if you are, I mean, it's a way to send a signal to some of these women that if they keep behaving the way they are, there's going to be consequences, and you can go on strike, if you know. And it gets to a point where just women aren't, it doesn't appear worth it to the men, because to take on all the responsibilities and risk of supporting a family, you should be granted a certain amount of authority, and I do mean that word, authority over the family, and that's the natural order of things. And a woman, in return for the man's going out and putting up with the job, doing work he may not want to do, and provide for the family, should be afforded a certain amount of respect at the head of the table. That is patriarchy to the feminist, right? That's, you know, these things. Yeah. Any institution that is supposed to be passed down from one generation or other that restricts you in any way or confines you or holds you accountable, to them it's patriarchy, it's slavery. But the alternative to that is making every generation invent the wheel. You know, it's insane. You can't do that. People need guidance in these things. They need, you know, young women aren't, you know, if young women are free to have sex based on their judgment, well, that the problem with that is young women, as a general rule, don't have good judgment. All right? So they need institutions and guidelines and rules to direct them in a certain way. That might be shame. You know, it might be certain expectations how you behave in terms of modesty and these things. These things have a certain function. Men, you know, they should be able to have certain expectations in return, you know, for having to support a family. The problem is that's been pulled, that rug's been pulled out from under them. And it's been, described as patriarchy is oppressive and these things, when it's anything but. And the irony is, the feminists who talk in terms of liberty and women's liberation, well, at the same time they're talking liberation, they're also big advocates of the welfare state and government bureaucracy and red tape and control. You know, so that's the other side of this. You know, all the single mothers out there who claim to be independent, who rely on taxpayer subsidized daycare and all types of other services provided that men are taxed to pay for indirectly, as opposed to paying directly for their family, these things. So there's no free lunch. But I think the ultimate goal here is to destroy the father figure, destroy the family, and enslave everyone to the bureaucracy of the welfare state, which is what they've largely achieved. Or a large portion of the population.
Yeah.
Look at the black community. You know, what the Great Society did to them. You know, and this might relate to why there's so many so many black men involved and men going their own way, because how the black father figure has been so targeted over the past 50 years through all types of forms of psychological warfare, entertainment, and these things. They've gone out of their way to make sure that many of the young men who would be fathers simply aren't capable of being fathers. And at the same time, there's also, you know, there was a Ms. Magazine article in 1973 called "Myth of the Black Superman" that was written, that, you know, said, you know, promoting black feminism and already weakening the already much maligned and damaged black father figure. The irony of all this stuff is like Roger Devlin writes, is feminism is a movement that thrives on its own failures. Hence, it's very difficult to reverse. All the crisis they create, they don't take ownership for any of the problems their own ideology and their activism has created. Like the rape culture, so-called rape culture. And they promote, they're out there promoting permissive sexual behavior. It's Helen Gurley Brown at Cosmo in the 60s, promoting hypergamy, actually. It was her thing.
Yes. Right?
Women could go out and they could go after any man, married or not, engaged, married. And what that did was that empowered the alpha male and actually made it that actually the lower rung males would not have sexual partners because you have many women chasing the few powerful men, the high status men who now effectively have a harem, and all these other marginalized men. Whereas prior to that, because of social convention, call it patriarchy, because of morality, is once a man got married, for the most part, he was no longer in play. So you had to settle.
Yeah. That was what monogamy was.
Yes.
is based in a lot of ways.
And so it
took monogamy to. So it was monogamy that enabled the non-alpha males to be able to, be happily married.
You actually create the irony is a lot of people thinking. I'm going to refer to Roger Devlin, and he says the sexual revolution did not create more sex.
What this was,
it created a situation where fewer men have a lot more opportunity to have sex because you have women who no longer acknowledge monogamy. But that marginalized a lot of other men, most men, and created less sex because they don't get it through marriage.
And that takes us back to where we started from with what I think is a big part of the crisis in modern marriage is the fault of women, and it's not so much the fault of women, because they're women. When I say that I'm not attacking femaleness or female nature, but it's the fault of women because the hypergamic tendency is indulged, women are told you go girl, you can have it all, and if he's not meeting your needs, then it's time to find somebody new, or you don't even need a man, this whole real poisonous message.
He is in Roger Devlin, he has a quote regarding hypergamy. He goes, women complaining about men's failure to commit, one suspects means merely that they are unable to get a highly attractive man to commit to them, rather as if an ordinary man were to propose to Helen of Troy and complain of her inability to commit, as women don't want to get married.
that's right. It gives them an inflated sense of themselves, which isn't to say, I say that sounds cruel, but we're all designed by God and loved by God. And so, we're all quote unquote special in that way. But this sense of, I'm a perfect and unique snowflake kind of mentality. And I'm a princess and you better respect, you better worship the ground I walk on. And you better.
So look at the princess programming of Disney or the Diva phenomenon.
Yeah.
Promoting all this behavior, and that coupled with all the aspirational programming, consumerism, these things, it can create a perpetual state of dissatisfaction in most people's lives.
Yes. So. That's the problem that I see in marriage, that, you know, the thing that stands out the most in my observations of marriages. And the other thing is, I mean, I guess that this is a part of it, and it might sound, I don't ever want to sound like I'm ranting or just, you know, I've got a list of complaints about women. Boy, women really frustrate me, you know.
No, just it's what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, I know. But,
you know, if we're talking about, you know, I don't know, if we're, you know, talking about the problem of how cab drivers drive their cars. Well, you're picking on cab drivers tonight. Well, we're talking about the problem of cab drivers, how they drive their car. That's what, you know. We're not talking about baseball or anything. I don't know.
But another aspect of it is there are so many times, I mean, it seems that, you know, I mean, and I think this is a part of the same problem, although it's just a different aspect of it. I've seen many cases where women just have, you know, these moments where they just flip out about something or other, or that, like, they're completely unreasonable, you know, where they behave like children. And I could give examples, but just they behave in ways that no man would ever be able to get away with behaving, in ways that are obviously not grounded in reason and rationality. And so, but it used to be, before feminism, it used to be that, you know, well, this is just women being women. It's you know, the men are the rational sex. Women are more, you know, emotional, are more in tune with their emotions. And, you know, it's the yin and yang, if you will, of the male and female relationships.
Hence the term hysterical, right?
yeah. But today, I mean, they're still hysterical today. They still indulge in hysteria. That hasn't changed. But now they want to be indulged. They want their hysterical, unreasonable, irrational moments, fits, if you will, to be indulged. Or they have excuses for, like, it's my time of the month or menopause or, I don't know, something. It's not always something that trivial or stupid, but something along those lines, that they want just to be indulged, and that it's like, if you love me, you'll put up, you know, you'll put up with, you know, like that awful, infuriating quote by Marilyn Monroe, you know, if you can't handle me at my worst, you certainly don't respect, you don't deserve me at my best. Like, God, so ridiculous. And so there's this pressure to accept them at their worst, and yet at the same time, you can't say, well, men are more reasonable and rational, and women are more like children, because if you say that, oh my God, that's so demeaning. How dare you talk to us like that?
And well, one thing is they can't accept any, they don't appreciate any, perhaps, humor regarding their behavior. Whereas men, supposedly, you know, all types of male bashing is considered, you know, that's not sexist. But if you tell a joke about female behavior being sexist, like recently Cam Newton, the quarterback, made some reference about it. He doesn't take female. By the way, I've heard a lot of people make the same remarks. He says the NFL is pushing all these women commentators, and it's just absurd. It looks ridiculous. It does look ridiculous. I agree with him. I'm not a big football fan, sports in general. Oh, yeah. But what he said was, but all of a sudden he's made to apologize, when maybe it's just his opinion. Yeah. Maybe to him it looks ridiculous. Is that something you have to apologize over?
Exactly.
You know, no,
exactly.
It's just his opinion. It's an honest opinion. It's him being honest. That's what I hear so many people say that. You know, then it's considered sexist, or just behavior in general, male behavior. You know, it'll be joked at, men will be made fun of, lampooned. But if you do the same thing about women, that's awful. You have to apologize. No, it's called a joke. And that's one thing that feminists do tend to lack, is a sense of humor. It's a social justice warrior phenomenon, too.
Yeah.
They're so filled with righteous indignation that they don't have time to actually think about what they're talking, what they're protesting.
Yes.
You know, they're shrill, they're loud, they're rude, they're crude, you know. And all of them are childless, usually. childless.
Yes.
And single.
Yes.
Which goes to, maybe that's the objective of these, you know, is to make everyone more like them. You know.
Yeah, well, and so it seems like it seems like all of this is just an extension of the, you know, gynocentric culture that's just indulge women, whatever, at every turn. You know, you'd think that if it's like men and women are the same, there's no differences between men and women, then it would be okay to say, hey, you're behaving like a child right now. You're being a completely ridiculous. You need to, I mean, but that's seen as demeaning if you talk to a woman that way when she is behaving like a child and unreasonable. Not to say that men are always reasonable, but, or that men can't be unreasonable too, but I've seen and heard about so many cases of women just, you know, flipping out and doing things, saying things, you know, whether they're, you know, incredibly insulting or hurtful things, or just behaving in a way that's completely unreasonable, that, you know, a lot of children would know better than to.
Well, a lot of this, is, I think, is a function of the breakdown of the family. And a lot of these young women didn't have the benefit of a father and to see a healthy relationship develop, perhaps between the man and woman.
Yeah.
And the things that they would experience and the advice of the father, the experience of a positive male role model, and from that you might get that sort of contempt for male authority.
And yes.
So they don't think they have to listen to the man. They can badger him and they can intimidate in their own way and just wear him down. And I see a lot of that even with women who don't even think of themselves as feminist. They've internalized this. And often it's women who come from families that have been broken up. I wouldn't call them necessarily dysfunctional, but disrupted families for one reason or another. Death of a father, abandonment, and these things. And this goes back to, again, this is another thing that would get a lot worse as the sexual revolution played itself out, because from the sexual revolution you get family dissolution. And then you have the children, the subsequent generations, which are then traumatized by the destruction of the family. And these things were foreseen in various memos written by Planned Parenthood, and like the Berylson memo, the Jaffe memo in the late 60s, that if they achieved in changing the sexual mores of the country through mass media, through education, universities, these things, universities were used as weapons in these things, because you had a large population going to college in the 1960s for the first time, largely subsidized by the taxpayer. At the same time, you had the cultural Marxists taking over the universities. They swarmed these places, and they took it over, and they became these areas where a lot of the women were radicalized, especially in terms of sexual matters, you know, free love movement, these things, where these universities. You know, so that's how it's played out, you know.
Right.
You know.
And you talk about the badger, the feeling like you can badger and just work men over, that whole kind of thing. I guess, you know, nagging is like a more benign version of that.
And nothing, as people became deracinated or alienated from their traditional religions and their, you know, their church parishes and these institutions they rely upon, they wouldn't have a proper screening technique. I mean, very simple. It wasn't, when I got married, I one of the screening techniques was marrying a Catholic girl.
Sure.
Who shared values, expectations. Yeah. So it's not a guarantee. Nor is it a recipe for bliss. That's not the reality. It's simply not a mature way to look at life. But the point is, you want to marry someone. I get the sense a lot of these men, when I'm watching that documentary, The Red Pill, they're blindsided by their wife, you know, or their girlfriend, and thinking, well, they're living a libertine lifestyle to begin with, and they're liberated. They're all free to choose for whomever they want. And the thing is, they didn't have any ways to screen or to make sure who they were marrying. Some of these men were marrying, you know, I could have, from a mile away, I could have told them there was a problem.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a whole, you know, we always, and a lot of people have been deprived of those institutions and those conventions in the name of liberation.
Yes.
Marry anyone you happen to have a fancy for, these things. So there used to be, people had more guidance back then. Of course, then the feminists were called patriarchy or enslavement. But again, young people, not just young women, I said it earlier, but I think young people in general aren't repositories of good judgment. So often they need these things to guide them. in the right. decisions they take, whom they marry. Like, marrying within your faith in these things is a protection. Sure. It's not a foolproof thing, and there's probably a lot of horror stories in there, but, again, take the worst example of something isn't a fair way to analyze.
Representative.
Yeah, not a representative of the situation. Yeah. I guess, watching the movie, I mentioned The Red Pill. You haven't seen it. I recommend you see it, because I think you will find it. It's a well-produced documentary. It's just by this actress.
Yeah, well, I know the woman who did it is, you know, has gotten all kinds of grief for it by feminists and by, I mean, I saw some interviews. It seems like Australia for some reason is just the worst.
Yeah, saw that. And I think she was like
some interview where, that she had in Australia, some like Good Morning Australia kind of show where they were just
real hostile. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, very hostile and just, you know, awful.
Well, I mean, it does very sympathetic towards men. And remember, a documentary like that is a corrective. It's a rebalance, yes. Attempt to rebalance things. So obviously, I mean, we've had enough of feminist propaganda and all their claims about not being paid enough,
yeah.
So it's nice that they would cite things like, well, 93% of all workplace accidents and deaths occur to men.
Yeah, and it's still men who die in wars most often, who have the most dangerous jobs. Or
he says you get paid only 70 cents on a dollar, but then again, you live 6 years longer.
And that's the thing that I'm talking about with feminism, with the current state of things, with gynocentrism. It's like they can have they're offered to have their cake and eat it too. They're told they can do whatever men can do, and it's insulting to claim otherwise. And yet, when it comes to all the negative things that men have to put up with, those things they can opt out of. And
well, they
say,
can't do
well,
whatever men can do. I'm going to go out on a limb.
Yeah.
They're not men. Women are not equal to men. They're complementary.
Yes, I agree.
It's a different relationship. A father is different than a mother. I mean, a mother's unconditional love, right? Generally speaking, it's unconditional love. The father is you call it conditional love, but the father's there to kind of tell the son when he's being an idiot as he gets a little older. And then when he's being harangued by his mother, to step in and perhaps calm him down a little bit and back up his mother, but explain to him why the mother is doing what she's doing. And this this creates a respect for male authority, same time a proper respect for maternal authority. But how many people don't have the benefit of that anymore? I mean, I remember one time I was years ago, I was at my girlfriend's house, and her brother was like 14 or something. And something occurred, and the mother got mad, and she was going to try to spank him. Okay,
14.
And the mother just doesn't. I mean, I'm not saying anything. I'm not interviewing. I'm just witnessing this thing go down, and I'm thinking. And finally, the boy is not going to submit, and especially not in front of me.
No.
And so he's not going to submit to this. So he bolts out the door on a cold day in his bare feet. Okay, he's not going to get spanked by his mother.
No.
He leaves until the father gets. I was invited over for dinner, so I was there. and the father gets home. The father tracks him down. And you see the father calmly explaining to him. And he didn't have to get spanked, but he was disciplined somewhat. But the father had to step in. Now, how many people don't have the father around to do that now?
Yeah.
And so this is an example where, the mother cannot do what the father does. Now, I'm not just talking about earning and these things. But these things, it's a different thing. It's completely different. It's complementary. And this whole one of the problems I have with the Red Pill documentary is focusing on equality and balancing, as if it's not so much that it's not women men and women are not equal, and I don't think this obsession towards equality has had a really damaging effect, because generally speaking, in a family, the father is the head of the family. He doesn't lord over the family. He has the burden of providing leadership for the family. And it was that figure, it's that figure that was a father figure that was deliberately targeted, by things like the authoritarian personality in the 1950s, by the think tanks, because this is how you enslave societies, you destroy the father figure.
And how many TV shows? I mean, I'm not in favor of censorship. I'm not saying anything like we should go in and make them change things, but how many TV shows, how many do we see? Have we seen the years through a few decades where it's always the father who's the bumbling idiot.
Yeah, so well, that's the standard now. Yeah.
Doesn't know what he's doing. We still see that today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not that I don't. It's not that, you know, anything is sacrosanct or that, you know, men should always be shown in respectful. I mean, I'm not above made fun of, but it's like this exclusive kind of, you know, it's so heavily weighted in that direction just to show men as and fathers and husbands as just completely stupid, and like the joke's always on them, and you know the wives are always just patient and putting up with them, and you know all of their follies, and it's
so obvious that everyone notices it now. I mean, it's just like I take it's not just, I mean, these things aren't just occurring, whether it's the development of feminism developed in the aftermath of the Kinsey Report and the publication of Playboy and the promotion of Playboy by corporate America, the creation of Hugh Hefner as a public figure, and these things. So these cultural currents aren't just naturally. This isn't something that's just kind of flowing together. There's a convergence here. They're being directed. And society itself, society, culture moves slowly. But if you have the control of the universities, education systems, you have control of mass communication, entertainment, media, these things, and everyone now is being directed towards, you know, consuming that, whether it's the lifestyle of the commute home, you're tired, you just, you know, collapse in front of your TV set and these things. You're subjected to mass media, you can be programmed to these things. And generations and generations have been programmed to accept these archetypes. I mean, there's a reason why you have, like, archetypes in literature, right? But the same thing, the archetype now in mass media is the useless, dumb, usually white male father figure, yeah.
The Homer Simpson.
The Homer Simpson, yeah.
Kind of
and
character.
So at some point, this is malevolence. It's conspiratorial, meaning that there's two or more people meeting in secret to do something immoral.
Yeah.
You know? So, and these things, I mean, listen, if it was just accidental, there'd be multiple counterexamples, and there aren't.
Yeah. It's very heavily weighted in that direction, and mm-hmm. and also very heavily weighted, you know, in the direction of showing white people in a bad light, there was something recently that I saw on YouTube. I think it was called 43 anti-white commercials, and just the, you know, it really, you know, it made me, it was very powerful viewing, because it was just the same thing over and over again. White guys looking stupid, you know, white guys making fools of themselves in front of mm-hmm. black guys, you know, white women preferring black guys to white guys.
Well, that's, that, yeah. Know. Yeah. And that's another thing is obviously if you make any mention of that, you're, what are you like? Anti-miscegenation? What are you like, 18th century guy? Well,
yeah.
No, but I can, believe me, don't insult my intelligence. I don't care who people, I'm not in the business of telling people whom they should, you know, fall in love with, get married and all this stuff. But when you watch a commercial, and there's a commercial for an automobile, and it involves three or four couples, and every couple is interracial.
Yeah, it's mixed. Yeah.
Okay, come on. I mean, it's not. I mean, it's, yeah. Or when, you know, was it the health department of Germany is producing those PSAs or telling, and they have these sort of these, you know, the artwork they use like in pamphlets. How they have a white blonde woman.
Yeah,
grown,
yeah, another one.
Having relations about, with a brown man. I mean, it's like, what?
Right.
You know, like I said, I don't care really. I don't care. But in the same sense, I do acknowledge the significance or the cultural significance of ethnic identity and how this actually is a bulwark or protection for people against globalism and these things, the assault on ethnic identity and how it's meant towards. It's a malicious attempt to homogenize the country, to enslave it, because otherwise this ethnic awareness or whatever you have it is a defense mechanism against it. If you're really ethnic identity, someone who's like really proud Italian and likes everything Italian, you know, is going to be less subjected to all the monoculture of Disney in these things. And it's a healthy thing. I made the point, if you like ethnic food, you got to preserve the ethnicity.
Yes, that's right. You know, being pro-diversity is being anti-multiculturalism.
Yes.
Because you want to preserve all these different cultures as they are.
And the reality is to defend diversity is you're going to have to acknowledge your some legitimate idea of separateness, of exclusion.
Yes, right.
Right? I mean, this is what makes life interesting. It just, you know, it's, and I'm, you're not a racist for defending, you're not necessarily racist for defending it.
Well, God made the different races, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, he made us the way he made us, and that's not to say that I'm against mixed race, you know, on mixed race coupling on principle, but just that in general, people do prefer their own kind.
I'm not against it in principle. I am against psychological warfare operations claiming that you have to have mixed
exactly.
race.
Exactly.
Like the president, was it, what was his name, Sarkozy? Suggesting that it would have to be mandated.
Something like that.
You know,
or like somebody, one of maybe it's the Austrian EU bigwig saying that someday we'll make all women wear the headscarf in Europe, to show solidarity. I mean it's that same kind of thing, and that relates back to what I was saying earlier about how. You know, these patriarchal non-white cultures seem to be getting imported here to, you know, for a malignant purpose as well.
Well, you create a sort of self-loathing or guilt, yes. Which only brings on contempt.
Yes.
It only brings on contempt. I was talking to my brothers today how their high school, you know, which dates, their Catholic high school, I think dates back to 1819 or something, its founding.
Mm-hmm.
Gonzaga High School in Washington, D.C. And I had three brothers who went there. And apparently it came out that at some point or another, Gonzaga's endowment was connected to some sort of financial interest tied to the slave trade. Mm. And now that some the provost or some official is now apologizing for that.
Yeah, do indulging in some virtue signaling.
First of all, it's meaningless. It's disingenuous. Yeah. He does not feel guilty about it whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's a lie anyway. So it's an insult. It's an insult to everyone's intelligence.
He wants to show what a good person he is.
Yeah.
And that's what virtue
is. I could have told him just by looking at that date, 1819. Yeah, I'm sure they had some financial tie. It was big business.
Yes.
Insurance companies, banks, everywhere. It's like there came out that Larry David. Seinfeld creator, writer, and Caribbean enthusiasm. Funny guy, funny Jewish comedian.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's a headline. He was shocked to find out that his ancestors were involved in the slave trade. Do you know anything about the Jews and slave trade? I'm not shocked by that.
That almost sounds like an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
It does, and I would say, you know, I don't think Larry David should be held accountable for that.
No. No,
you know, it's ridiculous, and it's just disingenuous to the extreme, and you know, it's everyone apologizing for something that occurred 150 years ago is ridiculous.
It's so tiresome. It's so beyond tiresome.
You know, and it's like the Gonzaga community is a public. You know, like no, we wouldn't. I were graduates. No, I don't. I've never enslaved anybody.
Right.
You know, it's just this nonsense. It's just
No doubt. No doubt about it.
And that's what someone would just say. No, I'm not going to apologize. It's stupid.
Yeah. That's what Cam Newton should have said. I mean,
it's stupid. I'm not going to apologize. Stupid. You know, this is stupid.
I'm not apologizing. What are you going to do about it? I'm already under contract. I'm not apologizing. I'm just going to keep on being a quarterback for the Carolina Panthers because that's my job. And I'm going to get paid millions of dollars and you can't make me apologize. I mean, that would be really refreshing if somebody would say something like that.
But you know, it's a hypocrisy. It's transparently false. You know, you're just posturing. They're virtue signaling. It's meaningless, absolutely meaningless. Because who benefits from that apology? No one does. Cause no, I mean, it's like
no.
So.
But, so that pretty much brings us full circle, I guess. the ills of the world, as relate to the relations between the sexes and feminism, but beyond. So.
Well, there was, I mean, here, if I can get this, where was I here? in the in this part, Roger Devlin's part in his concluding remarks, he goes, "Men are supposed to have authority over women. That is part of what a marriage is. Equality of the sexes makes men less attractive to women. It has probably contributed significantly to the decline in Western birth rates," which is the objective, I think. "It is time to put an end to it. Marriage is an institution that places artificial limits on women's choices. To repeat, nature dictates that males display and females choose. Monogamy artificially strengthens a male's position by insisting that each female must choose a different male, and each female must stick to her choice. Monogamy entails that highly attractive men are removed from the mating pool early, usually by most attractive women. The next women are compelled to choose a less attractive mate if they wish a mate at all. Even at the last and least of the females can, however, find a mate. For every girl, there is a boy. Abolishing marriage only strengthens the natural... Abolishing marriage only strengthens that naturally stronger. It strengthens the female at the expense of the male, and the attractive at the expense of the unattractive."
Yeah.
But again,
that's where we're at right now.
In a deeper sense, though, humans necessarily want happiness. As a philosopher says, during most of history, no one tried to figure out what young women wanted. They were simply told what they wanted, viz., a good husband. This was the correct approach. Sex is too important a matter to be left to the independent judgment of young women, because young women rarely possess good judgment.
There you go.
Politically incorrect, but I think it's generally correct. I think all people of good faith and wisdom will agree with that assessment.
Yes.
Of the situation, we just get away from this cult of equality, and what's mine is mine, and what's his is mine too. Which is a dominant attitude I find among a lot. So it's destructive. If you tail down men, you destroy the ones who are there to protect and provide for you, so you can have their children, your children, and the species can continue. And so I think in the final analysis, it all comes down to perhaps population control, creating enmity between the sexes, so you create... the situation we're facing today, all under the false promises of liberty and empowerment. We're being enslaved, which maybe perhaps it's the Freemasons doing it. So listen, Andy, anything else?
No, I mean, this has been a pretty comprehensive conversation, but I mean, I guess we can, if something occurs to me, maybe we can talk again sometime in the future and hash that all out then.
Yeah, okay, great. Listen, thanks a lot. And again, your podcast?
My podcast is,
What's the Nameless Podcast?
The Nameless Podcast. I'm trying to think the best way to find it. I guess just type in Nameless Podcast. It's also, I post to it at the Alternative Right, at alternativeright.blog. That's our current address after we got booted from our Blogspot address a couple months ago after Charlottesville.
Aftermath of Charlottesville, yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, and I've also got my YouTube channel that I've been more active on lately, and that's just my name, Andy Nowicki. So just go to YouTube and type in my name.
Any books you want to plug?
Well, the last one that I published was Ruminations of a Low Status Male, Volume 1, which I remember the title made you laugh last time. And I'm working on Volume 2 right now. And so that's all kind of related to the stuff that we're talking about in a way. I had Volume 1 released, and that's that was a couple months ago, and that's available. You can get it in hard copy form or ebook form, and I've got all my other books are on Amazon as well.
Okay, great. That's Andy Nowicki. Thanks. I'll let you go, and we'll talk in the near future.
Okay. Well, great. It's been fun, Tim. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming on. You're welcome. Good night.
Good night.
Big side of singing mountain stream, where the willows grew, where the silver leaf of maple sparkled in the morning dew. I braided twigs of willow, made a string of buckeye beads, But flesh and blood needs flesh and blood, and you're the one I need. Flesh and blood needs flesh and blood, and you're the one I need. I leaned against the bark of birch, and I breathed the honeydew. I saw a northbound flock of geese against a sky of baby blue. Beside the lily pads, I carved a whistle from a reed. Mother Nature's quite a lady, and you're the one I need. Flesh and blood needs flesh and blood, and you're the one I need. A cardinal sang just for me, and I thanked him for the song. Then the sun went slowly down the west, and I had to move along. These were some of the things on which my mind and spirit feed. But flesh and blood needs flesh and blood, and you're the one I need. Flesh and blood needs flesh and blood, and you're the one I need. And when the day was ended, I was still not satisfied, for I knew everything I'd touched would wither and would die. And love was all that would remain and grow from all these seeds. Mother Nature's quite a lady, but you're the one I need. Flesh and blood needs flesh and blood, and you're the one I need.
Thank you very much.